All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral W. Peach presiding. All of our business before this court draw near, and we shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Peach. To my right is Judge Allen, and to my left is Judge Meredith. We're here today to hear the case of Albert P. Blue versus David J. Shulkin, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 15-1884. Would counsel for the parties please note your appearance for the record?
Blue appears, Lieutenant Carpenter, also appearing as Lieutenant Earl and Mr. Robert Dawson.
Representing the Secretary is Stuart J. Anderson and Richard A. Bailey.
Thank you. Do you seek to reserve any time?
10 minutes,
okay. And then this case involves the Equal Access to Justice Act, and the issue is the appellant the prevailing party? Mr. Carpenter?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Blue. It is Mr. Blue's burden under the Equal Access to Justice Act to establish that he prevailed in this appeal by showing that the remand that he obtained was necessitated by administrative error. It is not correct that a concession of error or a finding of administrative error by the merits judge is a prerequisite to a finding of prevailing party. What is correct is that the appellant has the burden to demonstrate, regardless of whether there was or was not a concession or a finding. And if the appellant can establish that he was a prevailing party, then he is entitled to, in this case, have his fees awarded because the VA did not make an assertion of substantial justification nor challenge the reasonableness of the amount of the fee ordered. In this case, the appellant believes that the administrative error that necessitated the appeal is demonstrated by the court's remand order. It directed specifically that the VA on remand should consider the evidence, meaning the medical treatment records from the VA facility in California when Mr. Blue lived there, in the first instance, and directed the VA to provide such additional assistance to the appellant that deemed appropriate in light of this evidence. The VA's duty to assist was not met in this case. It was not met by the VA, and it was not met by the board.
So what do we do with the portion of the merit judge's decision that says it can find no error in the board's?
I believe you have to examine that as a panel to determine whether that is a correct statement or not. I do not believe that is a correct statement of law. I believe that the court was overly generous in that statement and that the statement at best is gratuitous and, in fact, is a misstatement of the law and the circumstances of this case. Mr. Blue put at issue his treatment in his original application at the medical facility in California. He also testified before the board that he had that treatment. The board acknowledged in their decision that Mr. Blue had asserted that he had had treatment, yet those medical records were not recovered. That is a violation of both the statute and the regulation and was a clear error of law, regardless of the statement that was made by Judge Mormon in his merit determination. And this case is before a panel now and is dealing not with the merits of the case, but with whether or not there was or was not a remand that was necessitated by an administrative error. That is a separate decision that must be made by this panel in consideration of Mr. Blue's EJA application under the proper interpretation and application of that act.
So you're not arguing that the merits decision either explicitly or implicitly found error?
I am not, Your Honor.
You want us in the first instance to either find that the merits decision was wrong or come up with an error on our own? Is that what you're asking us to do?
I'm not sure I would quite characterize it that way. If this matter, if Judge Moorman were still on this panel, I would be asking Judge Moorman to reconsider the statement that Judge Allen just alluded to and whether or not that was or was not a correct statement. But the question under review by the court this morning is whether or not there was or was not a remand necessitated by an administrative error. That is, if you will, a separate determination from whatever determination was or was not made, correct or incorrectly made, by the merits panel. Because this is an application of Title 28 and the EJA statute and not a review of the board decision. So we're not relitigating that question. We are simply here to decide whether or not, based upon the record before this court, Mr. Blue is able to establish, and I believe he has established, that there was an administrative error made by the VA and by the board, and more importantly, that this remand was necessitated by that agency error. And if it was necessitated by that agency error, then the holding in Motorola, as recently interpreted by the Federal Circuit in Dover, clearly requires a finding of prevailing party status.
So there seems to be a little bit of tension in some of the law out there about what we can look at. So I'm assuming you'd agree we can't just relitigate the whole thing,
absolutely,
right? In other words, write another decision that gives you different relief.
No.
Okay, so we're on the same page there. So how is that different than asking us as a panel to look at Judge Moorman's single-judge decision and decide that it reflects error given what it did? That's a very bad question.
I'm just a little concerned about your phraseology in terms of it. I wasn't sure which it you were referring to.
The decision from Judge Moorman. Right. Because it seems to me if we can't relitigate the question of agency error in the first instance, as if we were writing on the metaphorical blank slate, we have to start with the grist of Judge Moorman's decision. But what are we supposed to do with that doesn't run up against the idea of relitigating?
The notion of relitigating would be that you would arrive at a different dispositive decision. To review the question of whether or not there was or was not administrative error is not dispositive. Judge Moorman disposed of this appeal. Judge Moorman correctly vacated the board decision and correctly remanded it with instructions, although somewhat imprecise, that they needed to go get those records first, but then once they got the records, that they had to consider them in the first instance. But that, as I was responding to Judge Meredith, is not what we are here today. We are here today on Title 28. Under Title 28, the appellant has the burden to establish that the remand in this case was necessitated by administrative error. And you examine the remand itself, not any comment, if you will, or observation or even finding relative to error by Judge Moorman. What is before this court is the simple question of whether or not, based upon this record, Mr. Blue can point to a legal basis which can establish that the remand was necessitated by an administrative error. So you must examine not the merits decision, but the remand portion of that decision alone, and make an independent determination as this panel as to whether or not that remand in this case was or was not necessitated by administrative error. And that is established by the indisputable facts in this case. Those are that the records from California were not before the board. The records were not collected by the VA. The court ordered a remand to implicitly collect those records and consider them in the first instance. That makes Mr. Blue the prevailing party under the EJIA statute, and that is the determination that this panel is required to make. And if he was the prevailing party, then he is entitled to be reimbursed under the Equal Access to Justice Act.
And have you found, I'll tell you my conclusion, I haven't, found anything like this out there in the law? I mean, one way or the other, where the court, a court, is looking at another decision and making that determination of the existence or not of error in a context similar to ours. Because basically, your argument is something like this. It doesn't really matter that Judge Mormon said, I don't find error, because he did X. He did a remand based on Y, the records. And given that Y and the X, there could only be error. There's nothing else, right? And that you'd be saying the panel would have to look and say, it's error.
Yes.
Right? I haven't been able to find anything in which the court wrestles with a decision that says, I'm not finding error, but I'm doing this thing.
The direct answer to your question is, no, I have not been able to find anything that mirrors the circumstances of this case. But I would offer two observations. First, if Judge Mormon had continued on this case and considered the EJIA application on its merits, then Judge Mormon himself would have been required to re-examine what he said in light of the assertion by the appellant that he was the prevailing party, and to make that determination anew in the context of Title 28. The second observation that I would make is that I believe that the Federal Circuit has done this in a number of cases in which they have found that the decision on prevailing party, that the appellant was not the prevailing party, was in fact the prevailing party, and that the Federal Circuit did precisely what, in most recently in Dover, I am asking this panel to do, which is to examine anew whether or not the determination or the reference made by Judge Mormon about he could find no error is a correct statement of the law as it relates not to the remand, but to the determination under the Equal Access to Justice Act. Because we have a unique circumstance here in which the merit portion of this appeal is under Title 38. The EJIA portion of this appeal is under Title 28. And Title 28 imposes specific burdens. The obligation of the appellant is to make an allegation. If that allegation is challenged by the government, then the burden to establish prevailing party remains on the appellant. So that is the circumstance at law that this panel is confronted with. Has Mr. Blue been able to establish to the satisfaction of this panel that this remand was necessitated by an administrative error, independent of anything that may or may not have been said in the merit decision?
Can I ask you how you would address the court's case law that talks about the need for the remand to have been predicated on administrative error? And there are, for example, I think it's our case in Bridell talked about that there needs to be an explicit connection between the asserted administrative error and the remand. So if we were to find an error now that wasn't found both in the merit stage, how would you reconcile that?
I think the way to reconcile that is to look at the finding of administrative error by the court or a concession by the government of administrative error in the remand, if it's a joint remand, are dispositive of the question of prevailing party on the side of the finding for prevailing party. But that is not the end of the inquiry. The inquiry under Title 28 allows the appellant to make an assertion that notwithstanding what may have been said in the decision or a complete absence of a determination of administrative error explicitly articulated as our case law, the case law from this court, indicates. That is not controlling of the disposition of whether there is or isn't prevailing party established by the appellant. The appellant has an independent burden under Title 28 to come forward with a showing that satisfies this court, independent of what may have been decided by the merit determination, as to whether or not the appellant is or was the prevailing party.
If we were to find an error at the aegis stage, would VA be required to correct that error?
The VA is being required to correct that error under Judge Mormon's order. I don't think that any finding, as you suggest, would have any impact on the VA whatsoever other than the obligation to pay Mr. Blue's attorney fees.
Even if it was a different error, then you said that Judge Mormon did not find an error.
So you're suggesting that if there was a finding by this court of an error that dealt with something other than what Judge Mormon dealt with? I guess I'm not quite following your question.
You're saying that Judge Mormon did not explicitly or implicitly find that there was any error. So if we were at the aegis stage to say, yes, there was, say, a duty to assist error, is VA required to correct that error under our finding? And if not, is there any sort of enforceable judgment as to that error?
Well, let's make sure that you and I are talking on the same hypothetical here. In a circumstance in which no error was found, and I hope I did not misspeak by saying that I believe that Judge Mormon did not make a finding. He made a tangential finding in his phraseology of, although the court could find no error in the board's failure to discover the exact dates of the appellant's medical treatment. I don't believe that finding goes to the question of whether or not there was or was not legal error under the breach of the VA's duty to assist.
So let me to follow up on Judge Meredith's question, because I think, so here, if there were error, it was a violation of the duty to assist in not going out and getting these records.
Okay. In the first instance.
So, and I'm not sure if this is Judge Meredith's question, but this is how I understood it. Could we as a panel look at this and say, well, you know, in fact, there's a duty to notify error here, something totally separate from anything related to what the underlying decision is? It seems to me that that can't be what we could do, right? Wouldn't we have to be confined to at least the factual findings of the other decision?
Under the application of the aegis statute, I think the answer to that is yes, because the aegis statute, as interpreted by the Federal Circuit in Motorola, recognized that in agency review, that the analysis is different than the normal determination under the aegis statute, and that determination examines what the basis of the remand was for. So to the extent that you are saying this panel is limited to looking to the basis for the remand made by Judge Mormon, I think that is correct. Now, Judge Meredith, I'm not sure I answered your question. Could you bring me back? I'm sorry, I got distracted.
So if we were to find an error at the aegis stage that was, yes, not explicitly or implicitly made at the merit stage, is VA required to correct that error, and is there an enforceable judgment as to that error?
I don't believe this court, under Title 28, can go back and relitigate the underlying decision. So the answer to your question is no. I do not believe you could find, quote, another error. However, you might be able to find an error that was consistent with the ultimate order of remand by Judge Mormon. Now, the dilemma that the appellant is in is that the appellant gets a favorable disposition from Judge Mormon. He can't appeal that. His only remedy is to ask for Equal Access to Justice Act fees. And that's why it's important and why this case is important to establish the precedent that this court examines anew, examines independently the basis for the remand. And if it meets the Motorola and Dover criteria, then this panel has the, as it were, independent authority, just as a single judge would have the independent authority to find prevailing party, no matter the contest by the government.
So, Mr. Carpenter, you're saying that the legal error for EJIA purposes is the failure to assist.
The breach of the duty to assist.
Because they didn't get the records.
The VA did not get the medical records. The board acknowledged the testimony of the veteran about having been treated at the VA in California, regardless of the date or time frame. Under the duty to assist, because these are VA medical records, there was an absolute and indisputable duty to go get those records.
But based on, in some respects, on information provided by the claimant, or the appellant in this case, as to some information regarding the time frame, the place, the time frame?
Not relevant under the duty to assist, as the Federal Circuit found in Sullivan. What is relevant is whether or not these were or were not VA records. Now, if these were non-VA records, you have a different standard. But for VA records, those records are required as part of the 5103 capital A small a duty to assist to get those records because those records could substantiate the claim.
Let me add 5 minutes.
Could I follow up on Judge Beach's question? So scenario number one is the court does what Judge Mormon did here. It remands for the agency to go get these records. And it seems like the only way, tipping my hand, the only way that I think the court could do that is if it found error, if it found a violation of the duty to assist. But Judge Peach's question actually comes at this from the other side, which is, could we, under your view of how EJIA works now, 28 and 38, right, could we look at this and say, you know, if I were a single judge, I wouldn't have found a duty to assist violation, and I never would have remanded, so therefore no agency error, even though the decision here clearly remands? In other words, is this a one-way street? We know what Judge Mormon did, and we ask, how could he have done that? Would there be error or not? Or can we look and say, this isn't a violation of the duty to assist at all?
I'm troubled by the way in which you framed it in terms of, are you able to? Most certainly you are able to. If you did that, I believe that would be incorrect, and that on appeal, that determination would be reversed. But would this court be capable of making that decision, either as a single judge reviewing an EJIA application or a panel reviewing an EJIA application? I think the answer is certainly yes, coming at it from that other direction. Could you find that there was, in fact, no error?
Well, yes. Now, and, you know, I'm literally asking these as questions, right, because I think this is relatively uncharted. It could be that this is a one-way street. This is a one-way ratchet. That a court is constrained in reviewing EJIA based on the remedy that was given. And so, if the remedy that was given was remand to do something, that means we're stuck with that, and then we just have to figure out, is there error that led to remand or not? But we can't go back and say we don't think there was any error at all because then there wouldn't have been that remedy, right? That's one way to look at it.
I think that's probably correct, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I did not consider that from the perspective that that would be relitigating the merits.
Well, that's
that would go beyond the authority of the single judge to relitigate in the EJIA context, and certainly beyond the authority of a panel to relitigate.
And fundamentally, that concern was raised by Judge Meredith, right? We've got cases that say we can't do that, and then arguably there are Federal Circuit cases that say we do do things like that. And I think that's the tension here.
Yes, and I think it's the context in which those cases arose factually that gave rise to that holding that are distinguishable from the facts in this case, which are that the appellant is coming forward under his EJIA application and asserting that the remand was necessitated by an administrative error. There could not have been a remand but for an administrative error. This was not a gratuitous remand. This was a remand that was necessitated by an administrative error. Unless there's further questions.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. This Court should deny appellant's application for attorney's fees and expenses because he is not a prevailing party. He is not a prevailing party because the remand was not predicated on agency error as that has been interpreted. The Court found here that neither VA nor the Board erred, and the Secretary did not concede error. Prevailing party status requires agency error, or requires that the remand be based on agency error, and as this Court has identified for cases of remand, that requires either a finding by the Court of error or a concession of error by the Secretary, and that will end up being an exclusive alternative.
So if there was an error here, what was the legal authority for the Court to set aside the Board's decision?
Your Honor, Judge Mormon cited Majid for that authority and indicated that this was an argument made for the first time on appeal.
So are you, and I'm glad you pronounced that case for us. We had quite a spirited debate about how we were going to pronounce that. But so in those line of cases, I have not been able to find a situation in which Majid remand was predicated on anything other than a new legal argument.
Right? Yes, Your Honor.
Are you aware of any?
No, Your Honor. This is not like the other Majid remands that I have seen, in the sense that plainly there's no new statute at play here. And Judge Mormon also identified that the evidence was in the record. However, Judge Mormon identified that the Court was not the appropriate place to make a de novo finding of fact.
So I'm just wondering about sort of, this is an EJIA case under Title 28, we're doing all of that, but we also have to consider the sort of implications under Title 38. And so if the Court has the ability to set aside the Board's decision, when there are new facts presented or something factual on appeal, and that expands or alters the Majid remand, it strikes me that could have a number of consequences down the line. Should the Court say that's okay? I hate to put the Secretary's counsel on the hot seat for that, because I'm not sure. In this argument here today, that clearly is the best argument for you, but I'm not sure that necessarily is the best argument down the road for the Secretary, and we're going to have to wrestle with that.
Your Honor, because this Court should not be looking past the finding of, or the explicit finding of, no error, in effect, treating this decision as any other decision, it's not essentially a ratification. It ends up being that ship has sailed. If there are issues that need to be worked out in how that decision was made, there are other avenues to address that, but EJIA specifically is not the one to do that.
Sorry, can I clarify that? Are you suggesting if there was an error in the single judge merits decision, that ship has sailed? Is that, it can't be corrected at this stage?
Your Honor, yes, effectively. There are, we would be entering, I guess, an entirely different channel if we were to direct this into a relitigation on the merits of the case. And we'd be stepping into, at some point we would be interfering between this court and the Federal Circuit, you know, if we engaged in an appeal on the merits at the EJIA stage. And this court, in its discussion of the two cases that involved error, but error that was not a basis for remand, which is Burdell is one good example of this. In that case, the Secretary actually conceded remand in the first motion for remand and then filed a second motion for remand based on the subsequent passage of the BCAA. And in that case, this court found that that subsequent remand, which was the one granted, was not based on agency error because the actual remand, even though there was this floating concession of agency error, was not the one that received the stamp of approval by the court. And in coming to that conclusion, it reached back to Buckhannon. And in the case that started this line of cases through Motorola and down to this court, the Supreme Court in Buckhannon was centered largely on this concept of the judicial approval of the finding of error. In their case, there was no finding of error, so it was just that judicial approval, that judicial imprimatur idea comes from Buckhannon. And this court looked to that, and it looked to a second piece of rationale from Buckhannon, which was the idea that the EJIA stage should not be a major relitigation. And then it noted as a prudential concern what it called the anomalous result of having a different outcome on the merits and on EJIA. And in Thompson, this court again referred to the anomalous result. In that case, the court in the merits declining to address an issue and then deciding that EJIA was the appropriate case or appropriate time to do that.
But in so what about the fact that clearly when Judge Mormon issued his single-judge decision, his memoranda decision, the one thing we know that wasn't before him was anything under Title 28, right? I mean,
yes, Your Honor.
He was not making any decisions about EJIA. So that then came to somebody else later to make an EJIA determination based on the input of this other thing, right? The Judge Mormon's decision. So given that, why should we necessarily be constrained by the fact that Judge Mormon might have said, I don't find error? Because, of course, at the time, he wasn't considering whether or not an EJIA standard was met, right?
Yes.
And so what do we do with that?
Well, there are two things I'd like to point out for that. When we're talking about the fact that EJIA is under Title 28, a lot of those attorney's fees in context other than ours are going to be coming in under titles other than Title 28 as well. I mean, it's a statute of general application, which the Federal Circuit has never said that that is not an option, but that does not make this a special case for EJIA cases. And my second answer would be to go back to Buckhannon and I suppose reiterate the fact that it is that judicial imprimatur that is one of the driving concerns behind that decision. And although the Federal Circuit did not specifically focus on that point, this court has, as I've mentioned before in Burdell and then in Thompson, which was not cited in the briefs, this court has looked to that particular focus on the actual merits court finding being the moment at which EJIA eligibility comes up. So at least as this court has interpreted, that actually goes back to the rejection of the Cattles theory in Buckhannon, is that the sort of, I guess, finality of that question of whether there was error at the merits stage.
Although really, you know, I mean, Buckhannon starts this coming for sure, but it really deals much more with settlements, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, basically the government stopping doing what is claimed to be the bad thing. But here, I mean, the court issued an order to an administrative agency to set aside a decision and do something else. I mean, so I'm not sure how much Buckhannon helps you there. I mean, it doesn't hurt you, but...
That's correct, Your Honor. it doesn't go very far down this road, and the Federal Circuit has gone farther, but not all the way to where we are now. The Federal Circuit has, however, come down in cases where there was a remand for further development of the case, has come down on both sides. Not clearly enough to answer this question for us explicitly, otherwise we wouldn't be here, but the idea of remand for further proceedings, that is one of the requirements from Dover, but that is only the first one. And so I guess my point is only that the Federal Circuit has at least illustrated that there has got to be some kind of way of sussing out the difference between those remands for further proceedings that award EJIA and those that do not, those that have prevailing parties, those that don't. And although the court never had to hang a decision on this point, the Federal Circuit has in Gurley at least explicitly based it on the fact that there was no agency error. Granted, it was not a case where there was a remand that was based on something that was in the record, but still, it was a remand for, in that case, it was an issue inextricably intertwined, a remand based on judicial discretion in favor of judicial economy, and that was not found to have been to give a prevailing party because there was no agency error. Again, we have to move a step past that to come to the answer that this court has already come to, but it is heading in that direction.
So what rule would you have us write, right? So one of us will write an opinion, and so you, I know what your ultimate conclusion is, that Mr. Blue is not a prevailing party.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what test would you have us write to then follow in the future in a situation like this?
Your Honor, I think that the test that was articulated in, for example, Burdell will answer, I will answer that question of at what point does a remand for further proceedings. It covers our precedent from the Federal Circuit. It is consistent with Dover. It is consistent with Halpern and with Motorola. It is merely an extension into that gray area that's left because those leave only open the gray area. Okay, the court has not retained jurisdiction. And we have a remand for further proceedings. Is it based on agency error? Really, the only question is, does that based on agency error mean that did we get here because there was an agency error, or was the remand the result of an agency error? And this court in Thompson went into a fair amount of analysis on that question, consistent and pretty parallel with Bridell, really, in which it discussed, you know, which of those two options it is, and it came up with the idea that it must be the remand must have been based on agency error, the finding of the concession, because of Buchanan.
So are you functionally asking us to adopt a rule that, because I don't want to put words in your mouth, I really want to figure this out here, that effectively says the EJIA decision maker, here it happens to be a panel, but most of the time it wouldn't be, but the EJIA decision maker is bound by the conclusion of the merits decision maker, right? In other words, is it as simple for you that the merits decision maker said, I don't find error, and so even though he then went on to remand the case and set aside the board decision, the dispositive thing is that he said he found no error? Is that something that you would want us to do, to say we're essentially bound by that?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may add one caveat, one of the areas of discussion has been this question of implicit versus explicit. This court in Thompson cut a very narrow line on how far outside of the remand, which was narrow enough that it drew a concurring opinion about that point. There would be room for argument on the edge over on the edges at what point an action by the court constituted an implicit or an explicit finding of error. However, Your Honor, in the instance that there is an explicit finding of no error on the merits, that should end the discussion for the purposes of prevailing party under EJIA.
What if, hypothetically, we found a situation in which the relief that was given could not, as a matter of law, have been given without a an error. I'm not saying that I find that here. Let's just hypothetically speaking. So we have a merits decision maker that says, I find no error, but then imposes a remedy that, as a matter of law, could only be imposed if there were an error. What do we do with that? And I don't have a magic answer, right? So that's a true question.
Right, Your Honor. I think the answer in that case is, if it has managed to get this far as EJIA at that point, the court should not do what it has not done yet, which is engage in a second relitigation of the case. There may be additional possibilities for relief before we get to that stage.
Well, because sort of the interesting thing here is that the merits decision here was totally insulated from any review, right, effectively, because the Secretary wasn't arguably nobody could have appealed that decision. Right?
Your Honor, I would not have expected this to happen, but I think that it would have been possible to appeal the finding of no error as a finding unfavorable.
By whom?
By appellant.
Well, but I mean, most of the time you don't appeal an opinion's language, right? You appeal the decision, right? And so they won, right? And so you're sort of in a tough spot. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. I would admit, and certainly even under my interpretation, that it is a finding that is unfavorable and so appellable. It's still a tough spot either way because the odds of anyone taking that avenue are very slim, but also very unlikely to occur. We are dealing with a very unusual remand among a case of unusual remands. This isn't even an ordinary Majeed remand, which is not a common outcome for a case. And so there is a theoretical, I think theoretically it is appellable. I don't necessarily think that answers the underlying problem because I have a hard time imagining it ever coming up. But from a structural perspective, it should be appellable as a finding unfavorable, though I don't think it ever would be.
Let me ask you to address the appellant's assertion that the administrative error in this case is the failure of the duty to assist. That's how they see the administrative error.
I agree that that was the only error at issue at the court, and so that's the right way to frame it. It was not an error for the same reasons that we argued that it was not an error on the merits. We haven't, an explicit finding that the judge agreed with the Secretary's argument in that case, which was that the issue is not the question of relevance or anything like that. It's a question of whether they were adequately identified. And the court found there that they were not adequately identified.
They being the dates? What was not adequately?
I apologize. The dates of provided service in California, provided medical treatment in California. And on that basis, not being adequately identified, the duty to assist to obtain the records was not triggered. So it was not error. It was not error for VA to not obtain them. And then, I guess, to move the analysis a step forward, Judge Mormon also noted that it was not error for the board not to address this theory or this interpretation of the evidence that was in the record.
So if Judge Mormon hadn't placed the sentence in his memorandum that there is the sentence being there's no administrative error or there's no error on the part of the agency, then would the analysis in your mind be one of looking as to whether implicitly there was an error?
Yes, Your Honor.
The Federal Circuit was clear in Davis that it is an implicit or explicit. I would point out that there would probably be two sentences you'd want to excise before it really was a question of implicit findings of error. There's an earlier sentence in which Judge Mormon said that he agreed with the Secretary. But removing those, you would be in a question where this court here had to figure out what does this remand mean in terms of what would have been necessary findings that were not stated to get us to the outcome.
But because the judge put in the sentence, the explicit sentence, are you saying that we can't and shouldn't or wouldn't want to go into an analysis on whether it was implicitly?
Yes, Your Honor, because I don't know any way you could have an implicit finding one way that was explicitly rejected later.
Well, hypothetically, right, what if we're back to the question I asked you earlier, right? What if we're in a situation in which we say, given what was done, setting aside and remanding to consider documents, okay, that could not have been done as a matter of law without an error?
Right.
So let's just assume we have what Judge Peach was just asking you. We have that sentence or two sentences that say, I'm not finding an error, but just agree, you know, stick with my hypothetical, that we have relief that is granted that could only come from error. If we have those two situations, what does the court do, in your view?
That is a very difficult question, Your Honor.
Thank
However,
you.
In that case, the court should follow the explicit statement of the judge. I do not remember in which case I read it, but I do remember in preparation for this case coming across the idea it was in an implicit error finding case that the decisions by the court also had to be read according to the interpretive techniques that you would have to use to read a decision. So that being said, if I were faced with a question where there was an explicit rejection of a theory, then that would be as far as I would be willing to go down the road of pursuing this idea of an error to duty to assist. The judge has found explicitly no error in the duty to assist. That should answer it.
So what would stop, assume that I decide that I wake up one morning and I decide that I think all of these appellant's lawyers in this world are really bad, and I don't want them to get fees anymore. So I find a board decision in a single judge case that I do. I set it aside and remand for further adjudication. But in my stock conclusion, I say I set aside the board decision, I remand for further proceedings, and then my last sentence is, I expressly find no agency error. Now, I'm not saying any of us would do that, but if that were the case, then wouldn't that functionally shut off EJA under your view? Because we couldn't look beyond saying there's no error, even though what I did I couldn't have done without finding error.
Well, I suppose there are two points. The first point is that remand for re-adjudication is not always going to be a prevailing party subsequent passage of a statute, but I'm assuming you mean in a case where...
Right, something that isn't like a Majeed, you know, hey, there's a brand new legal argument, there's a new regulation, a new statute, whatever. It's sort of the finding of a medical exam, it wasn't adequate. But then I put it the last line of my memoranda decision, but just so everybody knows down the road, I don't find agency error.
Yes, Your Honor. That would obviously be legally erroneous in the hypothetical you put forward, in the sense that something about the decision means that cannot be correct.
Right, but of course that's the hypothetical that what I was following on with Judge Peach, right? If we have a situation where that is the case, but the decision says I don't find error, which one wins?
At this point, by the time we've reached EJA, the I find no error should win. I would point out that at least under our interpretation of the finding, or the outcome of of you having found no error means that it is appellable. And I was only pointing out that it would be error in the sense that it would be an error that we believe could be addressed through appeal of the decision on the merits.
Well, but see, right, and then we're back to the colloquy you and I had before, is that as a practical matter, I'm not sure anybody could appeal that, right? Because the Secretary, I suppose, could appeal based on the remand, but of course wouldn't want to argue that there was agency error, and the appellant wouldn't be able to appeal because they won, right?
So you know that have a different view on that, but if that decision arrived here, you would be effectively given two choices, and neither of them is great, but either you would, I guess, open the door of the relitigation on the merits, or you would be applying EJIA on the basis of a decision that you did not agree with. And neither of those is an attractive option. However, given the systematic implications on the one hand, weakening that idea that the remand must be predicated on the error, stepping past what's been long recognized as this preference against relitigating the merits in cases that could then be expanded or argued or applicable in other cases, versus a negative outcome that is, you know, based on a very narrow possible set of hypotheses of options, or a very unlikely hypothetical scenario. I mean, in your hypothetical, Your Honor, there is no good answer at all, but there is a better answer, and the better answer is to preserve the function of EJIA as a whole, because either this case, which is unlikely based on the nature of the remand, or in your hypothetical, which is unlikely just based on the nature of the practice of the court, it would not be a good decision to then change a rule that has informed the way we've dealt with EJIA in this court explicitly, and I would argue implicitly in the Federal Circuit up until this point.
Can I jump in there? In trying to interpret what the single judge merit decision meant, is it relevant whether we think that certain outcomes would not have been legally permissible? So in terms of sort of an assumption that the single judge would not have done something legally permissible, is that relevant in terms of interpreting the language that's here as opposed to relitigating whether we think it was correct or not?
Your Honor, it is relevant in interpreting the language. Our position is not that you shouldn't interpret this. That's always something you have to do with a decision. Rather, that the statement of finding no error is clear, such that any application of interpretive, any kind of theory of interpretation will still get you to the same result.
And in interpreting that language, what relevance should we attribute to the Bozeman site that talks about failure, pointing to evidence in the record that wasn't considered is not a new legal argument for purposes of issue exhaustion? What relevance should we place on that citation there that suggests that an issue exhaustion case like Majid
right.
would not apply?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that we read that to indicate that Judge Mormon knew what you might call the sidelines of his options, in the sense that he was aware that he could not call merely pointing to evidence in the record a Majid triggering issue. But that is consistent with his own statement earlier that this was a new argument. Granted, not the kind of argument that has been the basis for a Majid remand in the past, but nonetheless an argument rather than new evidence. And so I would suggest that indicates that he knew as what he was not permitted to do at one side of his authority under Majid, which is to call the evidence in the record a basis for Majid remand.
If this isn't a new legal argument for purposes of issue exhaustion, how would you characterize it?
Your Honor, it reminds me most an argument, a closing argument of the sort you might see in a trial court. But that is an off-the-cuff comparison.
So, because, you know, Judge Meyer's question is, for me, the central question in this, which is, as I look at this, there are these medical records that he had told the board existed, and he just told the board the wrong dates that he was in California. It's hard for me to get that even close to the legal type of argument. I know we can say it's an argument, but it's really, I mean, that's stretching it, right? Because really what we're talking about is, I said 71 to 73, and I should have said 75 to 77. That's really not what one would think of as an argument in the sense of we'll let the board consider that for the first instance. It seems like either it was a mistake for the board not to figure out that the dates were wrong, or it wasn't, right?
Let's add 5 minutes.
Your Honor, that is certainly – I guess the underlying merits of the decision, it's certainly something that can be debated, and I do not have a solid explanation of why this case was correct on the merits. And that is not because I did not think that it was an issue, but because it is a difficult case to square with the precedent or the other Majid cases we've seen. My answer, Judge Meredith, I think indicates that it is a different kind of animal. The answer to this question is not how do we square the merits. It is, as I indicated earlier, and for other reasons related to EJU, rather, should we be talking about the merits in the first place? I do not have, and I have not been able to craft a good answer for the merits. However, I do think that there are articulated principles that would allow us to not get to that point here. And so it essentially is a thorny issue, but one that we don't have to get to. In conclusion, Your Honors, appellant is not a prevailing party under any precedent of this court or the Federal Circuit because neither the Secretary conceded nor the court found error in the board's decision. And this court should not make an independent inquiry into whether there was an error. Thank you.
I believe the issue that the panel's been struggling with, particularly with the government, is more easily resolved than the colloquy that took place. The legal prism through which prevailing party must be examined by this panel is a question of law. The Federal Circuit treats prevailing party as a question of law. And this case is the prime example of why treating it as a question of law becomes critical. When you have the ambiguity in the merit decision about what the court's findings were or were not relevant to error, it is appellant's position that no explicit finding of non-error was made by Judge Mormon. There are two sentences on page 6, the second sentence of the first paragraph, which begins with thus, and continues, the court agrees the VA had no obligation to sift through a claimant's file to determine when and where he may have received treatment at VA facilities. That is not a non-finding of administrative error as the basis for the remand to go get those records. That remand is based upon a rule of law articulated in both statute and regulation to assist the veteran by getting all of the VA's records. The second sentence that the VA is relying upon as an explicit finding of non-error begins with the word, although the court can find no error in the board's failure to discover the exact dates. Again, that is not a finding of non-error as the basis for the remand.
So what if we disagreed with that? So this is the question then that I posed to the government. Assume that we have a situation where the decision expressly says, I don't find any error in the administrative agency, but I am remanding and requiring re-adjudication.
And that's why looking at this through the lens of whether prevailing party is a question of law answers that question. Because if this panel decides that in examining the remand order, that it could have only been predicated upon an administrative error, regardless of finding or concession, then Mr. Blue is a prevailing party. And that's the end of the matter. To go through the analysis suggested by the government is simply way more burdensome than is necessary. The whole purpose of the holding in Motorola was to clarify that you examine the basis of the remand. What necessitated the remand? And what necessitated the remand, regardless of the position that the VA now takes, is a breach of the duty to assist. There is no other legal basis for ordering the board's decision vacated and to go collect those records and examine them in the first instance. That's the end of the discussion. As a matter of law, was there a remand that was necessitated by an administrative error? And the answer is yes. Unless there's further questions from the panel?
No.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Okay, being no further questions, the case is submitted for review. We'll come down and meet counsel.